Hey there, Goblin here. I just wanted to give you a heads up that until recently, I've been uploading exclusively on YouTube. So head over there and check out my channel if you're interested in more content, as there are additional videos that don't get uploaded here as podcasts. Thanks for tuning in. Now, let's get started. Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to KGOB Goblin Radio. I'm your host, Goblin Queen, and you're just in time for our UFO Story Hour. In future shows, we will read stories from other sources, but I just have so much fun combing through these. So, once again, we will be reading from NUFON, or Northern UFO News, a British publication edited by the great Jenny Randles that features articles on the topics of UFOs, highlights current events, and records investigation reports of first-hand encounters. And that is precisely where our focus will be. In the tales you'll hear tonight, there may be mention here and there of flying saucers or some lights in the sky, but I have a particular interest in finding the stranger side of ufology. Odd entities, psychic abilities, abductions, and experiences that seem to overlap with other paranormal phenomena and folkloric legends. So, if that sounds like a good time to you, sit back, relax, and let's get started. January 23rd, 1976, Bolton, Greater Manchester. Working as a receptionist, Shelley had got off the bus to walk the 10 minutes or so to her then home on what was at the time a new, isolated housing estate, but is now much more built up. This was close to the Rumworth Lodge Reservoir. She saw two lights over the reservoir, quote, like black lights on a car, which suddenly swept towards her and hovered overhead. Now they were seen as on the side of a strange object, with a flat top and curved underside. A horrible vibration began. She could feel it shaking her teeth. In a panic, she fled home, and at 6:10 p.m. her mother called the police. An officer arrived at 7, and although not ridiculing her, plainly did not believe her, and suggested it had been a low-flying plane. Shelley flatly insists this is not so. There are other facts, which Shelley says she decided to keep to herself. As the object hovered, it was the size of a house, and at rooftop level. It spun round very fast, and then flipped onto its side, spinning more slowly. She is sure it was made of metal, and pouring out light from within. A tremendous force was pressing down on her head from above, pushing her into the ground. Suddenly she was running away, and the object was vanishing high into the sky. She ran into the house and dragged her mother out, paralyzed vocally and pointing at the sky. Her mother thought she had been attacked. It was some minutes before she calmed down. Shelley had got off the bus at 5:15 p.m. and arrived home at 6:05. At least 35 minutes of time are unaccounted for. The next day, whilst having a bath, she noticed a burn on her arm and side. Her parents confirmed this. Then her eyes began to hurt, and she became nauseous and dizzy. A doctor was called, but not told of the burn or the UFO. He diagnosed a severe cold. The symptoms lasted about 2 to 3 weeks. Over this same period, her fillings began to turn to powder, and all those in the top of her mouth fell out. Bottom fillings embedded into her gum, and she needed extensive dental repairs. Her dentist said he had never seen anything so bad before. The pain in her mouth began within an hour of the sighting. 9 days after the sighting, her mother got a phone call while Shelley was at work. It was a man, just saying, quote, "I am someone who investigates these things." Began to ask about health problems after the sighting. He would not say how he had traced her. The following day, he arrived at the house with a friend and interrogated young Shelley for over 2 hours. Her father does not know why he let these men in, because he knew Shelley did not want to speak to anybody, and especially that she had no desire to discuss the medical after effects. And when they treated his daughter very badly, he does not know why he did not throw them out. Both he and his wife were present during the whole interview and say that they sat there, mutely watching. These two men were in their late 40s and wore smart business suits. They had very sophisticated tape recording equipment, but refused to say who they were or where they were from, but insisted they were not press. They told her that if her father intervened, they would come back again and have to force her to speak to them. Only one of the two actually spoke. The other man, whom Shelley recalls as having only one arm, but both her parents disagree. The only point of major discrepancy in this weird saga, said nothing at any point, not even hello or goodbye. He was like a dummy, the mother suggested. The other man, who asked all the questions, would only say that he was called the commander. The commander was very stern with her and seemed to expect incredible accuracy in her estimates of time and size. When she told them she could not be that precise, he got angry. He did not just suggest explanations to her, he tried to browbeat her into believing them. He was particularly insistent on getting her to believe, quote, it was something the army was trying out, and repeated this several times. Shelley refuted this, and she was sure it was not, and eventually he gave up. They also made repeated attempts to get her to talk about burn marks on her body and refused to believe her when she denied having any. They demanded to see her arms inside, but she refused. This remarkable interview terminated, and none of the families seemed to find it odd until later when they started to talk about it. A week later, the man called again, and over the phone, under intense pressure, Shelley admitted to the burns, now faded away. The commander said thank you and put the phone down. They never heard of him again. Visitors very similar to this were reported by two other witnesses in 1978 and 1981. Shelley was also regressed to the visit by the two men. She described it was far more petrified than during the UFO experience. She said that the men were talking to her, quote, twice, in the mind at the same time as verbally. But her heartbeat and pulse rose to such alarming levels that the doctor had to curtail the experiment. Shelley also related the now expected psychic history, including the seemingly ludicrous statement that as a child, she could levitate herself at will. We tried to persuade her that this was probably a hallucination or a form of out-of-body experience, whereupon she insisted we drive round with her to talk to her mother. We did, and her mother claimed it was true. She had once seen Shelley float down the stairs right in front of her. I have not the slightest grounds for doubting the veracity of this case. As you can see, both parents independently verified much of the background, and if we fail to get the medical support from the doctor and dentist, it will not be for want of help by Shelley, who is bending over to assist us in finding them. Incredible as it all is, it has to make one wonder just how many other apparently mundane cases mask something a whole lot stranger at a subconscious level. My suspicion is that if we recognize this possibility, we would be well on the way to understanding the mystery of the UFO close encounter. Well, how's that story to start things off tonight? There is so much to that story. This had such a great example of a Men in Black encounter and contained all of the high strangeness details I find to be so fascinating regarding those types of stories. Kind of the glamored or hypnotized state that all of them were in, particularly the parents, that, you know, after the fact, when they think about it, they're like, wow, that was really strange. Also, why did I let them in? And why didn't I ask them to leave? It's like this compliance that you wouldn't normally give, but you're just compelled to. And the double speak, the telepathic speech at the same time as physical speech. Details like Shelley remembering one of the men to not have an arm, and the parents not remembering that, just so, so interesting. And like the investigator said, I think this might have been written by Jenny Randalls, actually, it started with such a just a mundane, kind of normal as far as UFO encounters go. Lights in the sky, a craft, but then leads to all these other strange encounters. And like I said in the intro, one of my favorite things is the psychic background that comes up from a lot of witnesses to UFO events. To me, it was very significant that when Shelley was divulging her previous psychic experiences, she mentions the ability to levitate and that her mother saw her float down the stairs. If you don't know, I have a video about people remembering the ability to levitate as children, and specifically the ability to float down the stairs. Strange as unbelievable as it sounds, it's become pretty commonly reported in the modern days of the internet. So it's fascinating to find an example of this from 1985, the year in which this particular newsletter was published. It really makes you wonder. In that video, you know, if you watch it, there's all kinds of theories as to what kind of rational explanation could lead to this commonly reported phenomenon. But nonetheless, it's interesting that so many people report it and swear by it. And Shelley's mother even said that she saw Shelley do it. Really, really interesting. So, great story to kick us off. We have a lot more to go, so let's keep going. KBJ, an ambulance driver and former NCO in the Army, married and with a family now resident in Cheshire, has two encounters to relate. The first, and less interesting, is the most recent. September 15th, 1979, 9:36 p.m., a clear, cloudless night at Salford Ambulance Station. Waiting between calls and watching meteorites, he saw two lights in the sky moving east to west. Dull red with a light edge and a halo of orange surrounding them, making them look fuzzy. They moved in a tag fashion, not linked to one object, but moving close together and independently. They took 20 seconds to move across the sky. There was no sound. September 1968, 3 a.m., Decalia Army Barracks in Cyprus. The witness was guarding part of the upper floor of the barracks with a large dog, a Turkish wolfhound. Suddenly, he was attracted by the dog growling, with his fur sticking up higher than ever seen before or since. This was most unusual, since the dog was, up to then, afraid of nothing. He sensed that the dog was alert to a movement outside. He tried to calm the animal down, but it refused to respond. It then began to cry and shake before crawling underneath the bed. He then became aware of a high-pitched sound, acute and penetrating inside his head. With this, he opened the door, leading onto a small landing and stairs immediately outside to see what went on. To his horror, he saw something coming up the stairs, with at first just the top of the head visible, but climbing to reveal the upper part of the torso in the next few seconds. It was humanoid, with a light blue, tight-fitting suit. The neck had a dog collar on it. The face itself was flat and had an orange glow to it. The eyes were very large and glowed red. The hair was red, thick, and rough, about 4 inches long and sticking out in all directions. The apparition appeared to float rather than climb and swiveled its head in a totally impossible fashion, almost 180 degrees, to face the witness full on. Not surprisingly, at this, he slammed the door shut. The high-pitched sound had increased, and his hands were shaking and his teeth chattering. He had locked the door and sat on the bed, terrified. The dog was whimpering violently, still under the bed. A sliding noise then approached the door, and the witness picked up his spear gun from beside the bed. Normally, this can only be loaded with great difficulty underwater. He pushed it home past the normal limit instantly, and only great control kept him from firing it through the door. After a few moments, the noise slid away, and the high-pitched sound stopped. He was still sitting on the bed shaking and holding the gun at 4:15 a.m. when a guard arrived. He says his arm, leg, and shoulder joints ached for a week, and the dog turned overnight into a devout coward, throwing its legs up into the air on its back at any threat, no matter how insignificant. That's a pretty odd experience. I'm sure it's already very nerve-wracking being in that situation and hearing someone coming up the stairs, thinking that you could be in some kind of combat situation, and instead seeing this extremely bizarre creature that almost sounds like some kind of anime character or something with thick red hair sticking out all over the place. It is wearing the skin-tight diving suit that is common in a lot of UFO experiences and descriptions. And speaking of floating down the stairs in our last story, this being was floating up the stairs. Totally strange. I mean, maybe you could say that because it was at 3 a.m., that maybe our witness was a little tired and delirious and surely stressed. And the dog reacted as well. That's a pretty unique story to me. Very interesting descriptors of whatever was seen coming up the stairs. Let's move on to our next story. The events focus around Mrs. Beryl Browett, who lived during the investigation at a house in Nether Edge, Sheffield, with her family. They have since moved to Wiltshire to be near Stonehenge, an area Mrs. B feels drawn to. David B is a painter and decorator, and there are also three boys, aged 13, 10, and 8. The experiences center around the thing which appears in the main bedroom. It is an amorphous, shape-changing blob that looks like fine particles of dust sparkling in sunlight or cigar smoke. It has been seen repeatedly by Mrs. B, but not the others. Yet it stopped appearing as soon as investigations began. It later transpired that the youngest boy and husband have seen it fleetingly. Mrs. B once walked through it by mistake. She felt a cold chill, but it did not impede her passage. The room is also allegedly very cold, but SSPR thermometers detected no anomalies. However, there seemed to be odd electrical effects, since one woman felt the fine hair on her arms rise as they would in an electrostatic field. And electrical equipment in the house have suffered many inexplicable failures. That Mrs. B is the medium through which these events operate seems to be suggested by her many other experiences. These include vivid out-of-body experiences where she drifts up off her bed. They turn into lucid dreams where she flies out of the window around a surrealistic landscape. There have also been the archetypal recurring dreams, telephone problems, minor poltergeist phenomenon, and a ghost. Mrs. B also had a UFO encounter in the company of her two eldest children when she collected them from their local school in September 1979 at approximately 3:30 p.m. The object was described as, quote, like a huge stationary balloon, silvery and hovering low on the horizon. It was, quote, absolutely enormous and disappeared behind a tree. A student teacher walking with them ran to a new vantage point, but it had vanished. Mrs. B claimed that others in the area had seen this object. Indeed, there was a local sighting on the 16th of September, 1979, of a very similar silvery cigar. However, this was at noon. It is possible that Mrs. B was mistaken as to the time. Preliminary evaluation of that case suggested a balloon, although none were actually traced to the area at that time. An interesting case of a psi-prone family. This is one of those mixed bag stories that I love that has just a little bit of everything. Honestly, I think that the UFO activity in this story is kind of the smallest part of it. And the main phenomenon that's under investigation, this blob that looks like fine particles of dust sparkling in the sunlight, that kind of sounded like a ghost to me, or what people had. It had the symptoms of a ghost. The cold chill when you pass through it, the room being cold, the odd electrical effects, kind of a electrostatic feeling. This is a lot of stuff you hear in paranormal investigations. A high electromagnetic field. So yeah, not sure what that could be, but interesting, of course. And I hope that Mrs. B had even more wonderful psychic experiences as they moved closer to Stonehenge. I would love to visit one day myself. Let's move on to our next story. A great pity that this case had to be aborted. The witness, 70-year-old Mr. K wrote a tiny note about his experience, filled in a response form, and then disappeared. Inquiries found that he had gone into hospital, from there to a nursing home, and could not be found after discharge from there. However, what we do have is very interesting and worth recording. In early May 1938, Mr. K, who would then be aged about 24, was in his native Poland. It was about 4 a.m., and Mr. K was in bed when he saw two, quote, men at the window. They were holding a heavy-looking piece of apparatus between them. They seemed to be young and dark-skinned, but Mr. K was unable to react, being paralyzed, quote, as if in a force field. After about 20 minutes, they vanished. The next day, in an adjacent field of rye, a flattened circle about 30 to 40 feet in diameter was discovered. It had four holes in the center, as if legs had been embedded into the ground. Mr. K believed that the medical problems he suffered in 1984 resulted from his encounter in 1938. That's a very short one, but much mystery and intrigue revolving around it, definitely heightened by them not being able to track down Mr. K. So, it seems that Mr. K saw two men outside the window, I'm not sure if they were floating or standing, and then following this sighting, the next day, Mr. K noticed that there was a flattened circle in a field of rye. This flattened circle sounds like it could be what people in ufology call a saucer nest, which, in my understanding, is different from a crop circle because crop circles have more of these ornate patterns to them, and saucer nests are just circular depressions or areas of flattened grass where it would appear a flying saucer has landed. And I could be wrong about that. Much of what I've gleaned about saucer nests is from Jacques Vallée's Passport to Magonia. And naturally, I can't mention that without adding the relation Vallée makes between saucer nests and fairy rings. This is in the second chapter of the book, and after describing several instances of saucer nests, most notably the Tully nests found in Australia in 1966, Jacques says, "Do I need to remind the reader of that celebrated habit of the fairies to leave behind them strange rings in fields and prairies?" He goes on, "On November 12, 1968, the Argentine press reported that near Necochea, 310 miles south of Buenos Aires, a civilian pilot had reported a strange pattern on the ground and investigated it with several military men. Walking to the spot where a flying saucer was earlier alleged to have landed, they found a circle 6 yards in diameter where the earth was calcined. Inside this circle grew 8 giant white mushrooms, one of them nearly 3 feet in diameter. In Santa Fe province, other extraordinary mushrooms have been discovered under similar circumstances." Another writer, reporting on Scandinavian legends, noted that elves are depicted there as beings with oversized heads, tiny legs, and long arms. Quote, "They are responsible for the bright green circles, called elfdans, that one sees on the lawns. Even nowadays, when a Danish farmer comes across such a ring at dawn, he says that the elves have come there during the night to dance." End quote. Not that I'm saying this experience of Mr. K's is a fairy experience, but I'm just noting the similarities and overlaps of phenomenon. Much to speculate on, but definitely a very intriguing little story. Summer of 1967, 6:05 a.m., Hartlepool, England. Mr. James Lupton was aged 20 in 1967 and resided then at Edinburgh Grove in the town. He was working at a factory called Aladdin's and used to walk home as he lived nearby. After finishing his shift until 6 a.m., he used to stay behind to allow the others to rush off for their bus. This meant that when he left, it was very quiet. The morning in question was still and warm. As he turned into Edinburgh Grove, he saw 3 lights which he took to be aircraft navigation beacons. One was white, one red, and the other green. 2 were flashing, and the other was constant, although he does not now recall which was which. Thinking nothing much of this, he did become puzzled by the utter lack of sound, as with no breeze and no traffic hum, he should have heard this, however high the plane was. Then he realized with quite a shock that, quote, there were no stars in the sky overhead. It was a very clear, starry night, and the only explanation he could find for this was that something was blocking them out. Looking closer, he recognized the culprit as a dark, circular shape, and the three lights were on the underside of this. It was drifting in a weirdly slow motion, quote, so low I could have hit it with a stone. It spanned a considerable width of the sky, several rooftop widths in diameter. James ran through the garden and into an alleyway that leads to the back of the row of houses. As he did so, he waved at the drifting craft and called out, "Welcome to our world!" He admits that this seems daft now, but at the time it made sense. He watched it until it was out of sight, about 2 minutes, quote, looking like a great silver pan. It looked, quote, well used, stained, pitted, and was blacker than the lightning sky. Feeling both elation and astonishment, he went inside and straight to bed. His wife and 15-month-old son were both asleep. The room was dark and the curtains drawn, but the moment he slid into bed, he became totally paralyzed. Quote, my eyes closed tightly. I could not raise my arms or legs, nor could I feel my heartbeat. As I lay there thinking of what was going on, a piercing voice was repeating a message to me. It started to tell me over and over, you have a great secret. The voice was very unusual, and he was at the same time as hearing it, trying to force himself to ask questions, but he was very frightened. Finally, quote, I forced my eyes open, and my arms and legs shot upward. My heartbeat became very fast. All sounds in the room had temporarily vanished, but at this sudden termination, they returned. He could hear his wife breathing now. The room was filled with a pungent odor like sulfur, and he was quite literally petrified. He cuddled into his wife, pulled the blanket over his head, and curled into a ball. Despite refusing to close his eyes or go to sleep, he remembers nothing else until 3 p.m. that day. He has only told 4 people in the 19 years since the events. So there's a lot of kind of the typical symptoms of a UFO experience. And if you want to say so, a sleep paralysis experience. But that still doesn't explain what he saw as he walked home. So while he was in his bed and having this kind of paralyzed state, he had the Oz factor effects of all the sound being sucked out of the room while he was being telepathically communicated with. And he suffered time loss after he apparently fell asleep, but he couldn't remember anything until 3 p.m., and he probably didn't sleep until 3 p.m., considering he had a young baby to take care of. It was probably also terrifying, and I don't blame him for not having told very many people about it, because not only is it probably pretty hard to grapple with, I'm sure many people would just write the experience off if you told them, especially back in 1967. So, very strange, and it does have a lot of these recurring symptoms and themes of other reports. Mrs. A.B. is 41 and lives in West Yorkshire. Her experiences began in 1971 when she regularly, quote, used to see a small yellow ball of light moving around near the electricity pylon at the top of the field. This was always at night. She also once saw 4 cigar-shaped objects, one silvery, the others brown, static in the sky above this field. It was broad daylight. Then followed her one experience, quote, which left me in no doubt that there is some other intelligence in the universe. It happened in October 1977. At the time, she was living with her common-law husband, Stan, at Low Moor near Bradford. They were driving down a busy Queen's Road in Bradford at rush hour, about 5:15 p.m., and were going to get some wine for dinner. To the southwest, they both saw a stationary ball of yellowish light. Mrs. A.B. thought it was the same one she had spotted over the pylons a few years before. Every time they had to stop at lights, it stopped. Whenever they turned, it turned. When they went to the supermarket to get the wine, it waited for them. It followed them home. What if it lands in the garden? She asked, and Stan joked about her being beamed up. In her sketch, she draws a round blob and says, quote, I feel a bit silly just drawing a circle, but that's all it was. I wish it had been more interesting, but it wasn't. Astute readers will have out by now that this is a classic description of a bright planet, Jupiter or Venus, for instance. All the features fit. However, upon reaching their cottage at Low Moor and getting out, quote, the light suddenly and swiftly moved across and stationed itself a few feet above our roof. As it was moving, it made no sound whatsoever. Optical illusion? Or was this more than a star? Her beliefs are quite clear. Quote, I remember thinking that if there was any life inside it, it must have been very small, as the perimeter appeared to be about 12 inches, if that. Alternatively, the light may have been moved around by a remote control from a mothership. She kept popping out during the next 6 hours. It was still there. In the morning, it was gone, which does very much suggest the true explanation for this experience, although Mrs. A.B. refuses absolutely to accept this. However, the follow-up is more than interesting. About a week later, after watching TV until midnight, Stan announced he was off to the loo. She went to check the front door was locked before going to bed. She went to the glass porch and remembers touching the door handle. Quote, the next thing I know I'm in bed, waking up from a very deep sleep. Stan is not there, which is unusual at weekends. I went into the sitting room and sat down, and he said, well, I hope you're not going on a walkabout tonight like you did last night. She had lost the entire night, and it was now well into the following day. Stan told her he had become worried when he could not find her. The Yorkshire Ripper was then loose. Eventually, he found her outside staring at the road. He called her name. She did not respond. She seemed to be in a daze, so he took her by the arm and led her back inside. She had been missing for about half an hour. Having read stories of abduction, she now feels that hypnosis could tell her the secrets of her missing half hour. So, as Jenny Randles says, this does at the start seem like it could just be a misidentified planet seen in the sky, but I do think it's interesting that they had this experience seeing this ball of light seemingly kind of follow and mimic them as they're in the car. Lots of experiences happen while driving. It's something that's very interesting to me. I have several videos about paranormal experiences that take place specifically while driving. And balls of light are a common occurrence across paranormal phenomenon, whether it's ghosts, you know, orbs, fairies, like will-o'-the-wisps, and UFOs. Obviously, there's lights in the sky, but there's also this book by Paul Devereaux called Earth Lights, where he examines balls of lights and likens them to the UFO phenomenon, but has interesting implications about it. Definitely check out that book. It's very interesting. And all his books. He's a very interesting writer. But the missing time at the end of this report and her husband finding her just absentmindedly staring outside, that's very eerie and unsettling. So I don't blame her for wanting to seek out hypnosis. I understand why she would want to try and find answers. Also, that's crazy that this took place while the Yorkshire Ripper was on the loose, on the prowl. Terrifying. Anyway, let's move on. On July 15th, 1989, Mr. M was on Ilkley Moor. It was the middle of the night. The reasons for Mr. M being out at this hour were not yet revealed by the source. However, at 3:15 a.m., he returned to his village and went to bed. While Mr. M was still sleeping, his wife got up to go to the shops and met a neighbor who lived opposite, who reported that at 3:30 that same morning, his mother had awoken on hearing a loud noise. Outside was a, quote, fantastic sight, which both of them saw. A metallic oval studded in red, green, and white lights was low over Beamsley Beacon, north of the village. It made a loud noise, quote, like a vacuum cleaner, and glided away very slowly, looking just like a row of lights in the distance. This is a flight path for aircraft into Leeds Bradford Airport. Meanwhile, back to Mr. M's family. His six-year-old daughter had woken at 3:15 and, through a half-opened bedroom door, saw a human-like figure climbing the stairs. At the top, it stopped and then just vanished. She fell back to sleep and the next day had forgotten all about this. At 7 p.m. 2 days later, it all happened for a second time. The figure was still this time, for a period of about 35 seconds, and she now recalled the details of both events. She describes the two beings as similar, although the first was a man and the second was a woman. They were, quote, none too friendly looking, with angry eyes, and just 5 feet tall, with grim features and puffed out cheeks. Their arms were long and thin, and faces white. The female even seemed to wear pink lipstick. They wore one-piece black tracksuits. The suit covered the hands, legs, and feet. Mrs. M. also remembered during the investigation that in 1963, she had very briefly seen a man in dark clothing at the front window. Then he vanished. Around that time, they were plagued by phone calls, with nobody there except a strange mechanical bleep. These events may be unrelated, but there are obvious similarities here with other cases in the UFO records. John Keel's books are full of them, and Alien Contact describes many episodes like these. It is also worth noting that this young girl did not term the figures as aliens, but as ghosts, begging many questions. I thought it was interesting at the end that they noted that the young girl did not term the figures as aliens, but as ghosts, because I was kind of thinking the same thing. Obviously, besides their odd appearance or like details, like the puffed out cheeks and the tracksuits, they did vanish. And when the mother said that they remembered seeing a man in dark clothing at the front window who vanished, that just reminded me of a ghost experience that someone would describe. So, as always, there's this overlap. What is aliens to one person is ghosts to another. Definitely the tracksuits are something that aligns with UFO reports, of course. And just the odd high strangeness details to their appearance. And then there's these weird phone calls with nobody there. That, in terms of UFO experiences, is something people get after sightings, I think, kind of in relation to Men in Black encounters or contact. But also, you know, with like ghosts and paranormal, phone and mechanical glitches, malfunctions, oddities are common as well. There's a couple interesting things going on. There's a craft, there's weird noises, there's odd figures. At the end, they mention John Keel's books, and I haven't really read as much Keel as I should. I'm still a newbie to ufology, so I still have a lot to read. I'm very interested by John Keel, of course. I know him primarily for The Mothman Prophecies. But I definitely would like to read more of his books. If you have any favorites or ones that you think take priority, let me know. And then they mention Alien Contact, which they have in all caps as if it's the title of a publication. So I tried looking it up, and I did find a book called Alien Contact by John and Anne Spencer. But it was published in 1997, the one I found. And this Newfound Journal is from 1989, so I'm not sure. Maybe it's a series of books, because the one I found looks very interesting. I think it's different accounts of UFO experiences, so I'll definitely be flipping through it, and it may provide for some reading material for us in the future. Who knows? So the next story we're going to read is a pretty brief one, but nonetheless interesting. The following is an anecdote reported by a couple of readers from Gwent, Wales. On a recent visit to Scotland, they picked up this story of an acquaintance whom we will call Jack. The story was told with great sincerity. Jack is now 60, and this occurred when he was a young man. He lived on the north coast of Scotland in a place and time where all the lighting came from gas lamps. A close friend had just died, and soon after, Jack woke up to see a glow by the door. At first, he thought the lamps had gone wrong. The whole room was full of light. Then, suddenly, the room vanished, and he was standing in another place. "I thought I was dead," Jack said. His dead friend was there, standing between two men in white suits. They wore helmets with visors and had just slits where the eyes should be. Jack's friend looked distressed and said, "I am not gone." The feeling during the experience was very odd, feeling as though time was stretched out. The two strangers took Jack's friend away, and suddenly, everything was back to normal. So that one, who knows, could have just been a strange dream, but still very odd with the appearance of the men in white suits, with the helmets, with the slits. It does have kind of like a sci-fi feel to it, for sure. That would be upsetting, not only to have your friend pass away, but then have this upsetting, distressing vision or dream of them seeming like they were being taken somewhere against their will, possibly. I don't know. Very strange and probably very upsetting and confusing for Jack. Another one where it's kind of difficult to place the phenomenon, if it has any relation to UFOs at all. Who knows? But it's definitely interesting. That's the point of all of it, is that it's interesting. I know I make categorizations and stuff, I bring that up a lot, and that's not the point to file everything into its particular category. It's just interesting. We don't know what it is, and I'm just speculating. And really, I just really enjoy hearing people's stories, as I'm sure you do too. That's why you're here, right? So let's go on to our next story. Mrs. P lives in Safety Bay and describes what took place in 1985 when she was age 48. In the early hours of winter morning, she, quote, woke up. It was about 6 a.m. and cold, so she snuggled up to her husband to get back to sleep. What followed was, quote, in no way similar to ordinary dreaming, nor would I have read of out-of-body experiences. It was real. She found herself in the bathroom staring at the mirror, which became dark gray. She knew a, quote, guide was about to appear. She adds that she is normally a spiritual person, but considers talk of such guides to be wish-fulfillment fantasies. A figure now appeared in the mirror, and out of the corner she sensed another who said, I'll just go check on the other one. This she assumed to be her sleeping husband. She found herself, quote, in a high of excitement, asking many spiritual questions, but getting no obvious answers. Then the being's mouth became smaller and smaller until grotesque. This persuaded her that the energy to forge the contact was being lost. In desperation, she asked, am I progressing properly? And the being said, yes, just keep on the way you are. Just don't get mixed up in any hanky-panky. Then she asked, when will I see you again? And the being impatiently replied, oh, I'll call in about 20 years. Allegedly, the attitude was not, quote, love and care, as expected of guides, but very casual. The second guide returned and reported that her husband was, quote, okay. Then they walked into the passageway, totally ignoring Mrs. P, and talking very loudly to each other about how best to accomplish the next task on their agenda, which she cannot recall, but thinks was due before they returned, quote, home. She was worried, as her husband hates being woken by noise, so warned them to be quiet. They looked at her as if she were an idiot, gave a vivid scowl, went back to their discussion. Mrs. P now realized they were not talking physically, and she woke up in bed, amazed. Mrs. P only connected this with UFOs with recent reading of Abduction, which is a book by Jenny Randles. Yet she was always baffled by the appearance and garb of the quote-unquote guides and their total disinterest in her, seeming to find her a nuisance and an assigned job that had to be gotten out of the way. Not exactly what you expect from a spiritual entity, as she pointed out. They were tall humans with high foreheads and brown blonde hair. The one seen most clearly had a skin-tight blue ski suit. The attitude was rather like a man who comes to read the meter, trapped by a gabby resident, and forced by politeness to hang about. To me, there was something very humorous about this report. I don't know if it was just kind of the delivery given in writing, but also just some of the details that jump out to me, that the aliens, spirit guides, whatever they are, they're annoyed with her and they tell her not to get mixed up in any hanky-panky, interesting terminology. And yeah, just the dialogue exchange was very sassy, very, very funny. And, you know, maybe they were kind of rude. Maybe these aliens were kind of assholes, looking at her like she was an idiot, ignoring her. But maybe she was projecting, not in a hubris way, but I don't know. Maybe, you know, she jumped the gun a little bit, thinking that these were guides, spirit guides. You know, as she said, maybe they were something else. Maybe they're on some other assignment. They weren't there to guide her or cater to her. This is something that us humans do kind of project. We like to project meaning onto things, occurrences, and maybe things aren't specially meant for us. Maybe spiritual beings, aliens, whatever they are, have to go about their tasks and their business, and we're just getting in the way if we think they're there to cater to us. I also thought it was funny that she was worried about her husband being woken up because he doesn't like being woken up by noise. So she asked the aliens to be quiet. Very humorous. She doesn't seem disturbed. So, you know, I'm not trying to be rude and write her off and laugh at her experience. If she was totally terrified and scarred, I wouldn't laugh. But she seems totally comfortable. She just started firing off questions as soon as she saw a spiritual entity. So, kind of a fun little account. Not one of the more scary ones. All right, we are going to go out on one more long story. Let's dive in. November 30th, 1978, West Yorks. This witness, Jay, wrote after reading one of my books to briefly describe a case which, quote, still haunts me to this day. Her letter was so intelligently constructed and restrained, despite the story being of great interest, that we arranged an interview immediately and were not to be disappointed. The location was Walston, a small hill community near Todd Morden. Jay would walk her whippet dog on the dark moors by her cottage. She was constantly alert in this isolated spot, as the infamous Yorkshire Ripper was on the prowl at the time. Often she saw satellites, but also countless, quote, small lights that moved erratically about the sky. On November 28th, she saw two lights on her walk. They flew side by side from the northeast, then split up, and one flew silently south towards Manchester, the other west, across the haunted moors, toward Backup. It was such a common sight that she barely took much notice, merely watching. Then, 2 days later at 6:30 p.m., she was with her dog after horse riding at a hillside stable, as was routine. But for the only time, the dog literally slid to a halt in the middle of frolicking and gazed up. Looking upwards herself, Jay saw an incredible object silhouetted against the slopes to the west and above them. She admits that if the dog had not seen it, she would have walked right beneath it without noting a thing, as it was so low and yet totally silent. Jay did a double take, looked back, and it was still in the sky. By now, she was transfixed by it. The object was lens-shaped and shrouded by a glow, with a neon blue body inside and three round holes she took to be windows. In an interview, she displayed the absolute awe that the sight evoked. It was like a feeling of spiritual oneness. Jay pointed out that she was raised as a Catholic, but is not now especially religious. But seeing this left such an ecstatic feeling, it was just as she would imagine meeting Christ to be. Everything else vanished from her consciousness, and she and the object were, quote, joined at the soul. She later tried to rationalize why it did not cast light on the ground, despite being so intense and low down. In the center, with the blue body and yellow windows, it was sharp, but there was a weird greenish-silver cloud about it, which thinned towards the outer limits. It was as if the dazzling light of the thing was contained within the haze. Now came the most bizarre part, and the reason why she felt too stupid to report the story to anybody before. She felt, rather than heard, with a voice, with words, telling her soothingly, "Do not be afraid." In an instant, she went from unimaginable terror to calm, peace, and almost loving security. Jay says that now, she realizes it was almost as if the object were luring or hypnotizing her as she was fixated on it. For this reason, and many others, after much thought and discussion with investigators, she has changed her mind about initially asking about hypnotic regression and decided she does not want to go through this. She adds, quote, "I swear that if something had got out of that thing and said, 'Come with me,' I would have followed like a lamb." Next came a sensation that all her experiences from birth onward was being rapidly sampled by the unseen occupants. Note how closely this case parallels a near-death experience. The Oz factor, bright light, voice, bliss, and now even the life review. I am convinced this is by no means a coincidence and shows the vitally important clue that exists within the fact that both near-death experiences and UFO close encounters are altered states of consciousness, possibly even the same event, with minor variations of interpretation. The experience ended similarly to a near-death experience as well. She knew the thing was going, felt terribly sad, pleaded with it to stay, but was told she had not been harmed, would be protected, and it left, splitting in two, trailing a shower of sparks like a stone zapped from a catapult. She stood on the moor in tears. Much of the terminology used by this highly intelligent and absolutely trustworthy witness is, itself, fascinating. She says that during the encounter she felt, quote, "divorced from myself," and added, quote, "it was as if it drained me. All my essence went into the UFO. I know this sounds terribly subjective, but it was as if I was a computer terminal. It gets so frustrating visualizing it, but not being able to put it into words." Now the experience, quote, "hovers on the border of my memory, and I know there is more that I do not remember. It is teasing me at the edge of understanding, knowing it had happened, but realizing it was impossible, and you could not believe it yourself, so could never try to tell others. I always believed before this that if I saw a UFO, I'd tell the world, but it wasn't like that." Jay's encounter is one of the most interesting of recent years, made more important by the background to the witness herself. She was born in London and moved to Kent soon after the experience. Between the ages of 5 and 3, she had regular experiences where balls of light would appear in her bedroom. They were basketball-sized, and she used to call her mother to say, "There's a fire in the room." As soon as her mother came, they vanished. As soon as she left, they returned. She grew, feeling very empathetic, always knowing people's inner selves and responding to animals. She also developed the ability to, quote, "travel to visit friends without going there," a form of remote viewing or out-of-body experience, and indeed, she had one very vivid major out-of-body experience at age 13. When she traveled, she could later confirm her visits by checking facts that she saw. Jay told us, quote, "I have always believed that if I need to be somewhere badly enough, then for a few seconds I can go." On at least one occasion, her apparition has been seen by a close friend in Kent, even though Jay was physically in Yorkshire at the time. As a child, flying dreams were also very common, as were frequent false awakening experiences and lucid dreams, where she knew that she was dreaming and could control the story and experience of the dream. Her memory of very early childhood, such as being in her stroller, is also strong, which is another emerging clue spotted again and again with close encounter witnesses. Jay has also had vivid premonitions. In one case, she rescued a woman from a car accident near her home when she sat up instead of going to bed, knowing that it would happen. The car would overturn, and she would need to be there to free the stranger from the wreckage. She has also had a classic experience with a ghost on a beach in Kent in 1980. At the age of about 11, she encountered a regular bedroom visitor, a female surrounded by a lovely green aura. "I quite missed her when she suddenly failed to turn up anymore," she said. We are not certain as to whether there is a time lapse in the close encounter of 1978, but Jay does recall other instances where she has lost up to 2 hours from her memory. This was when aged 17. We have discussed the possibility of regression hypnosis with her, but she has decided against this, saying, quote, "I believe that one day I shall know the truth of all this, but I do not think the time is now." Jay concludes, "I can't stand these hoaxers who make up stories. I am not saying I have a message to change the world, if it's real, and I use that word because I don't know what it is, but Assuming it was real, then whatever it is must be so superior to us that we wouldn't have a leg to stand on. But I hope they don't land, because we are dealing with something so different that the world would hurt them. Ooh, wow, I really, really like that story. There's so much interesting stuff. First of all, we love people like Jay. I do. Totally strange, totally special, open-minded, in tune with their emotions. And it's not an easy life to live, as I'm sure many of you know, being so emotionally open and empathetic. You know, it's difficult. So some other interesting things that come up is, well, the Yorkshire Ripper comes up again. Isn't that interesting? Both of these took place in the 1970s, so in Yorkshire, but interesting that that came up twice. I did not plan that. I loved thinking of Jay walking her whippet on the dark and haunted moors at late at night by her cottage. That sounds like a great activity. Maybe I can do that one day. Walk the haunted moors at night. I do think it's interesting, as Jenny Randall's pointed out, the similarities between near-death experiences and UFO experiences, particularly in this story, but it's something that Jenny Randall's has written about and studied extensively. I've read another article of hers where she talks about it, and it's not difficult to draw parallels. And Jay mentions that when she saw the craft, she was overcome with this sudden calmness and peace and security and protection, and that she realizes now that it was almost as if she was being hypnotized or lured or coerced into this feeling. And I've heard someone else describe this realization about a similar experience, that when they had this kind of UFO experience, possibly an abduction experience, that they felt this overwhelming calm, and even the beings saying, "Don't be afraid," as they do in the story, and that it feels very pacifying. And that afterwards, they looked back on it almost like they were being pacified for a reason. Who knows what could have happened if Jay just went along with them. And then one more thing I have to note is that Jay remembered she had a lot of flying dreams as a child. And I wish I could ask her if she had any floating or levitating memories, because it does sound like she might. She might. A lot of the people who have the floating down the stairs memories do think that they feel very dreamlike and think maybe that they're dreams until they hear other people talk about their experience and think, oh, wow, that really did happen. I would love to hear all of Jay's experiences in great detail, but what we heard tonight was interesting enough. That'll suffice. I hope you enjoyed all the stories this evening. I really, really enjoy doing this. I actually have a lot more that we didn't get to, and I would just keep going, but I'm going to cap it at around an hour so that I can get this out according to my schedule, which is every other Monday. That's where we will stop for tonight. Thank you so much for joining me and for tuning into KGOB Goblin Radio for our UFO Story Hour. Make sure you check the skies before you drift off to sleep this evening. And I'll see you next time. Good night.